Tony Schwartz calls up McLuhan to talk about his new book, 1973.
You can actually condemn a man to death simply by shaming him. And
no, that's not the one I want to play. Just thinking, what is that? Nine, five, six, four, three, one. Okay. This should be it.
Back to you, and I'd like to, if you have a moment now.
Yes, I do. Hi, Marshall.
Hello, Tony. How? I just happened to be in town. Okay, we came in from Paris last night on our way home.
Oh, wonderful.
Stopping over, saying hello to Stephanie. And what's with the response of court? Is it?
Well, it'll be out this fall.
I see, not until September.
No, and I've gotten lovely comments from many different environments.
Well, good. Look, I'm supposed to be doing an issue off of, there's a literary magazine, a regular stout academic item called New Literary History, edited by Ralph Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And he has asked me to do a communication number of his magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And to look up the right people. And I was hoping to get a piece, short or long, doesn't matter, a few from yourself. I just want to put the right people into that magazine.
I'd be glad to do anything for you, Marshall.
Well, that's great. Now, you must have had lots of things come to mind since your book was formed. Something on the Watergate, perhaps, from a sound man's point of view.
Can I play it for you?
Yeah. What have you got?
I'll play it for you right now.
You've got a bit?
I'll play it for you on tape.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And you tell me...
Well, maybe we should come around and hear it.
When are you free?
Well, as a matter of fact, we are free as of now. But you're in the middle of lunch, are you?
No, that's not the problem. I have a meeting in a little while for an hour or so. I'd love to see you after that.
When are you free?
I'm free, say, at... let's see, that would be about 1:30. About 2:30, 3 o'clock would be fantastic.
3 o'clock. Let's try to drop in about 3 o'clock. Now, your address is...
455 West 56th Street.
455 West 56th.
Yeah. Let me... That's the Watergate over Coca-Cola commercial.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Great. Tony, you must have picked up many sidelights on it.
Yes.
What it inspired me to do was to ask myself, what would happen if all the microphones in the world were suddenly silenced? And what the heck is the mic? And even in the world of... the Catholic liturgy, where I've been poking around a bit, if you silenced all the mics, the entire changes that have taken place there in the last 10 years would cease. They would automatically end, and nobody has ever studied what the mic does to the relation among people. And I know you have a bit in your book, but politically and liturgically, ritualistically, it's amazing what that thing does to language and to the relation of audiences and speakers.
Well, you know, there's an interesting thought that goes through my head as you start talking about the Watergate thing.
Yeah.
And that is, it's one factor is that wherever there are media valleys, for instance, New Jersey is a media valley. Now, New Jersey is between New York and Philadelphia, okay? And it gets Philadelphia television and New York television. But it has no television of its own. So you find most of the old type of corruption existing there because the state has no sense of itself from media. And you find that corruption exists in these media valleys, Delaware, the old type of corruption. Now, the interesting thing is that Watergate is like a super level that exist from media mountains.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's a fascinating thing to look into, and I'd love to talk to you about this.
Well, maybe we'll get a chance to say something about it to each other.
All right, fine, and you could tell me about the article, how long you wanted, on what subject, and
yeah,
so forth.
And maybe you'll think of a couple of other people who should be in the issue.
Okay.
Well, I hear you're going to be also in John Culkin's setup.
I told him that I'd be glad to help him anytime.
That's darned interesting.
Yeah.
Well, 3 o'clock then, Tony.
Fine. Looking forward with great delight.
Right on.
Okay. Bye.
Visual or the more literary kinds of approach.
Yeah. See, I'd like to...
In a detective story, the ideas of time are very diverse, to put it mildly.
See, the fascinating thing about time in another dimension of in use of, say, film and television technology is that the question, for instance, I used to, a few years ago, I used to play with the idea that people used to travel by steamboat, by boat or steamship or railroad train, and in every picture to show the passage of time or travel, they would show the 20th Century Limited coming around the bend, or the ship. For instance, for Charlie Chan, in an old Charlie Chan movie, to travel from China to New York took about 30 seconds. You'd see him going down to the ship and then waving goodbye and all this. But today, people travel by swish pan, or by doorknob, in that the camera will go into a doorknob in New York and then pull back from that into a room in anywhere else in the world.
Well, could you write on that very theme?
Yes.
That would be wonderful.
Fine. And how long do
you... how would you yourself wish to describe that this area of comment? How would you like it?
Well, I think the whole area has something to do with the question of the...
What about the representation of time in different forms of media? You see, what you mentioned just now, the representation in the film medium of traveling from China to U.S., 30 seconds of images.
See, a fascinating thing in hearing and in seeing from television or even film, everything is always instant, is always now.
Uh-huh.
And for instance, I've been recording the news downstairs. I've been recording the news every day. I record 20 minutes of the news off the radio, and I'm having someone transcribe it. Now, what happens if I pass by the person who's transcribing it? I hear it as if it's happening today, even if it happened 3 months ago.
Right.
I react to it as now. It is always now. Anything you hear is always now.
It's amazing. The newspaper doesn't have that effect.
No.
Yesterday's newspaper is dead.
Yeah, it's garbage wrapping.
I think these would be very valuable comments, Tony. Feel free to...
Just go wherever it goes.
Yeah, do an inventory of them. You don't
Fine.
Have to fill it out in paragraph form. Just make
Fine.
An inventory.
Fine, I'll do that. I'll be delighted to. Then I have photographs that can show it, too. I mean, I take Polaroid pictures of television frames to show you. I can take three photographs and show how in one photograph the man is talking to you. In another photograph, he's talking to man in another time zone.
Yeah.
And then in the next photograph, the same person is talking to the man right next to him. So he talks to the man right next to him to... He talks to you and at home on the television set, and he talks to someone in another city, and it's only his change, slight change in expression, slight change in movement of his eye, or something that encompasses time zones, thousands of miles, and millions of people, from millions to one, that all these other frames that existed in previous eras are all destroyed.
Now notice then, under the newspaper, you have under a single date line a mosaic of items gathered from every geographic area on the planet. But it's all in one image under one date line of one single mosaic frame. And you can't do that, can you, in any other medium except the press. You can't build that sort of simultaneous image of many time zones all under one date line.
You see, I a very interesting thing. Just on the news a minute ago, they interviewed Gary Powers, this guy who was shot down in Russia, you know, the pilot. So they interviewed him, and he said, yes, they lied about my being there, you know, this sort of thing. You know?
Yeah.
Now, the fascinating thing is that what's happening in Watergate is a conflict that this national environment, which learned to behave one way internationally, is in conflict with the literate criteria that they're forced to behave by here. And that's what's in conflict.
Yep. Different time zones indeed, different cultural zones.
Different eras. They function by one rule internationally and by another nationally, and that's really what's come in conflict, that the Nixon administration tried to run their work by the same, they want to be in sync with themselves. And they find that it's hard to live two split lives, and they found one much more effective.
It is really getting, it's going to get crazier and crazier. I wonder who's trying to orchestrate the whole thing. They probably have a big team of orchestral thinkers. Oh, boy.
The funny thing is, I don't think they're aware of the music.
Well, remember that the people in an orchestra don't hear no music. Remember, the players, the performers in an orchestra hear no music at all.
What do they hear? They see notes.
They just get noise.
They just read notes.
And they don't even hear the guy beside them.
Yeah. That's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
But, have fun with this. Follow it where it goes, Tony. Simply indicate how other people could follow it up. You see,
yeah.
Try to exhaust the whole subject.
Yeah.
And open it up, eh?
Yeah. Okay. And again, I can't tell you what a pleasure it was seeing you and how much.
It's a shame that we don't live closer. We could have.
Yeah.
We could really do a lot of things.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. You're one person that makes me feel like the whole world is there to learn. You know.
Well, it's there. But
yeah.
Whether we know it or not.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be in touch and.
All right, I'll send this book to you, Marshall.
Send a draft of your thoughts on the time thing. Send a little draft from time to time, and then we can discuss it by mail.
Fine.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. So this is in 1973. Watergate's in the. They're doing the Watergate hearings that summer of 73. We'll move this forward 8 minutes to get to the next part. 2026. Right there.
Good morning, Marshall.
Yes, who is it?
Tony Schwartz.
Well, Tony.
How are you?
Fine, dandy. How's the book coming along?
Fine. Be out in the beginning of October.
Oh, dear, they've been pushing it all. It was going to be September.
No, the end of September is probably, you know, but it'll be on the market in October.
Well, good.
The beginning of October.
Well, I certainly hope it's going to. I think it'll go very well.
I hope so. You know, you have no idea till it hits the market, you know.
It's a needed book, and there's nothing like it, so there it is.
Yeah. Several things. Did you get the book on jazz?
Thank you, I did. I've been able to get into only a bit of it so far.
Yeah.
That's the Stern.
Yeah. You know, another copy.
I appreciate that because I know those are rare books.
Yeah, I found that, and I went out searching for it and went through five or six stores and finally found it. So you can keep that one.
That is awfully good of you.
Yeah. Marshall, there's something that's been staying on my mind since. First off, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed seeing you the last time. It was such a treat and a pleasure. And
well, I wish we could get together once in a while. I may be in New York in a few days.
Well,
I've got to come down there to see a publisher.
Well, if there's any chance of seeing you, I'd love to. Secondly, one thing keeps going through my mind, and that's this idea of outdoor space being outdoor visual being acoustic, you know, for instance, like things, the airplane getting smaller just as things do in sound, you see?
Well, no, the problem there, visual space is static.
Yeah.
Now, digital space, though, is enclosed space.
Yes.
And the acoustic space is not never enclosed. That is, as such, it has to be all directions at once. Which is, you see, the dome. Acoustic space lends itself to the dome, not the rectangle. No flat planes in acoustic space.
Yeah. Now, why do you call it visual space static?
Because, as in Euclid, all the properties of visual space are static. They're continuous, connected, and static.
Yeah.
This is not true of touch, or taste, or smell, or movement, or hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Those spaces are all discontinuous and dynamic.
Now, you say outdoor space is discontinuous.
Well, no, outdoor space is not necessarily visual space. You can have some visual characteristics in it.
Yeah.
There's very few spaces are pure.
Yeah.
They're nearly all mixed. They're nearly all multi-sensuous.
See, I was looking at it in this light. I find that when you're in a room, everything seems to stay constant.
Oh, yes, that's a closed space.
Yes, whereas when you're outdoors, even things the same size, a tree nearby is large, a tree distant is small, just as with sound. Or things going by, if a truck goes by, it's large as it comes near you and goes, you almost have a visual Doppler effect, you know?
Yes, it's multi-sensual space, mixed with hearing and all other facts, and with movement and touch. Jesus, by the way, tactile space is a peculiar type of space.
What is that?
Each of the senses, osmic space, the sense of smell, has its own peculiar space.
Yeah.
Each of our senses creates a peculiar space.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. The sense projects itself into its own kind of space.
I find this fascinating. I want to look into it. That's why I wanted to hear you more on it,
In the Principles of Psychology by William James,
yeah,
you'll find some indications of various kinds of space, including tactile space, auditory space, and visual space. But he doesn't really know what the hell they're made of. He doesn't understand their properties.
Yeah.
But this is back to 1880. At least they were talking about the different kinds of space here.
Yeah. Now, I've heard you, and I agree, and I call, you know, I begin to see a difference, and not many people accept this. I begin to see a difference between reception and perception. And I define environmental media as received media, in a way.
Well, environments may be man-made. They may be projected. But they come back. They feed back into our sensorium.
Yes, well, what I mean in a way that radio and TV are media you sit in that are all around you and they come in at you. So I call them received media as opposed to perceived media.
Well,
does that make sense or not?
I don't think it's adequately worked out, Tony. You have to. The psychologists have worked out these sensory matters a lot better. It's worth checking in on their terminology.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Get a good book on sensory psychology.
Do you know of one?
There are various books on the world of perception. There is one that comes to mind alone. For example, E.H. Gombrich in his Art and Illusion has a wonderful treatment of visual space.
Yeah.
E.H. Gombrich, G-O-M-B-R-I-C-H.
Yeah.
But I'd be at a loss to tell you anybody who has a good treatment of acoustic space. I don't think there is such a
thing. Yeah. See,
is the space of the bounding line. It's the space of cubism.
Yeah.
And there's damn little on this.
Yeah.
The painters are better at it than most people.
At tactile space.
Well, at all kinds of space.
Yeah. But
Tony, you're really plunging into a world that the psychologists have done damn little about.
I know. See, the reason I feel that there's a meaningful difference between reception and perception, firstly, using the word reception instead of perception makes people think of a difference.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's totally based on resonance, you see.
Well, now, perception requires a certain energy. And what we perceive and what we choose not to perceive is a very mysterious business. You see, we filter out, know a great deal of what's available for perception. We filter it out, throw it away.
Yeah.
We select. Now, this is very mysterious. Why do we push some of it down into the unconscious?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, here's a book you must look at.
You know, I have a videotape that just gets right into what you were speaking of. You know, you say everything we see and hear is stored inside us.
By the way, Tony, there's a book by Bartlett.
Yeah.
C.S. Bartlett.
Yeah.
Remembering.
Yeah.
Be sure to look at it. It's very much concerned with what you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay.
He points out that what we remember, we really restructure.
Yeah.
That remembering is restructuring. And
yeah.
That perceiving is really making.
That's interesting.
Now, reception, too, we only hear what we choose to hear.
Yeah.
So it's very mysterious why we filter out.
You know, I have this videotape of this hypnotist taking a person back to 4 years of age, to 1 month of age. And at 4 years of age, he can remember things, the toy he got on his fourth birthday, what he did with it, and so forth. So it really lays out that point that you say it's all in there. The question is, how do you gain access to it, or how do you re-evoke it, you see?
Yeah. Well, it's not necessarily desirable.
No, and he also says that an interesting thing. He says that the hypnotizable person is one who generally just takes in things. He doesn't... He's not a sorter of things, and if you have a person who's generally not a hypnotizable person, they're a person who generally sorts out things, and much they disregard.
There's a book by Dixon, D-I-X-O-N, on subliminal perception,
mm-hmm.
a McGraw-Hill book.
Yeah.
I think it's a book you ought to have a look at.
Okay.
Because it has a lot to do with about what causes us to force things down out of sight.
Yeah.
In perception. But this book by... Bartlett, C.S. Bartlett, Remembering, is worth looking at.
Well, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
That sounds...
I've got to run, Tony, because there's somebody waiting for me.
Okay, thank you.
I'll give you a shout as soon as I hit New York.
Fine.
In essence, I put on the recorder now, so I'm recording. In essence, you were telling me, you know, if you could just put it in some sentence or two of... this aspect that you felt that this book, you know, originally you thought this book was for media people, but you think it goes...
Okay.
Say something and then you can take it around.
My initial impression, is reinforced by reading the preface even, was that the book is about mass communication, and in it are very good pieces of wisdom for advertisers and others who would persuade or communicate on me. But that indeed in reading it, the thing that struck me overwhelmingly is that your notions of considering the effect of communication, the environment in which communication takes place, being much more important than the content or the message, is something that we all need to think about, because we're all involved in communicating every day with many, many different people, and the notion of striking the responsive chord is just as important and much more pervasive when two people get together and talk as it is when somebody goes on television.
Good. Good. Hi, Eric. This is Tony Schwartz.
Hello, Tony.
How are you?
Good to hear from you.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
Good.
I had a lot of fun with your book of late. I wish I could see a hardbound copy.
It'll be out on the 21st.
Oh, terrific.
Good.
Well, you've got a promise to send us some, because we've been quoting it, and it's hard to know what page references to give from the galleys.
Fine. I will get you... How many would you like?
Oh, two or three would be delightful.
Fine. Fine. I'll be...
Yeah. Just a sec, I'll get that.
Okay.
There he is. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Marshall.
Well, what puts you onto this auditory medium?
Well, I got your lovely letter, and it was so exciting. I just loved it and was thinking a lot about it. And the one about the effect of the microphone on the church.
Oh, right.
That's weird indeed.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it's funny you say that another effect of the microphone is to turn the priest around to face the congregation. So now he puts on the congregation rather than putting on God.
Yeah.
It's also made fathers brothers.
Which father? The clergy father?
The clergy father.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a big brother now, or just brother, yeah.
Yeah, brother, because he's on a much more intimate basis with someone.
Well, he's more like a Protestant padre.
Yes, yes. Now, another fascinating thing that in the... See, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, in the... you know, larger, more traditional churches, that the microphone has been used as a supplementary system, a sound supplement, which has just made the church like a living room.
Yeah, and, which destroys the architecture of the church altogether.
That's right. But in the small churches, it does another thing. In the small churches, it makes a man God.
Yeah.
You see, in the Pentecostal and the gospel churches, it's used to wipe out all other senses, so there's nothing between you and the pastor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the sound is so at such a high level that it just wipes out any other sensory input.
Yeah, and you see, I don't know if I've mentioned it in this particular piece you got. The meditational quality of the Latin Mass was dependent somewhat on the low mumble and mutter.
Yes, which left you alone in a way.
Yeah, and you could fill in as you wished.
Yeah.
But with the high-definition vernacular, it's like having a rule book read to you, and you haven't got a moment to think about anything.
Yeah, yeah.
The ritual thing is gone.
Yes, I thought your letter was so delightful to me. I mean, it just was such well, I'll tell you what I liked about it. I liked, one, the fact that, you know, you're looking into this area. Two, that the letter had a consistency and a development in it that was so exciting to see. And it really just opened the whole area to look into. I've been very conscious of this because my office now was a church. And we used to hear it through the walls in our building next door.
Yeah.
And when my daughter was young, she'd say, "Daddy, turn off the church." Yeah. But I always wondered, why was the volume so loud, you know? And it was because it wiped out all other... You know, there was nothing between you and the pastor. He was totally surrounding you. You were sitting in him.
Almost like a soul singer, right?
That's right. You were sitting in him, totally.
Climbed inside the mic.
That's right. So,
Well, I'm trying to... look, I've been looking at some other media lately, including the hologram. And,
I know a guy who's working with it a lot, and he's just getting into it, and he sent me... I'll send you his address, name and address. His name is Harry Pritchett. He's up in Boston.
Like to be in touch.
And he's just getting involved with that in relation to television and so forth. I'll send you a fax of the letter he sent me, which will give you what he's into.
Did you see Richard Schickel's wild attack on me and More, a paper called More, a paper called More?
Where is that available?
Oh, it's New York paper.
Oh, that son of a bitch, you know.
He's bringing out a new book himself, and this is a chapter on me in his new book.
Mm-hmm.
On meditation, speculations on celebrity in America. And it's a wild swinging attack, quite unscrupulous.
You see, to me, one thing I'm glad in relation to you is that McLuhan as a fad has passed. But to me, McLuhan as a giant is just beginning.
Well, thanks.
In that, you know, look, from my position... I feel that my book stands on your back, you know, in that...
It certainly doesn't stand on my toes, though. I don't feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, what I mean by that is that what you have opened doors that people like myself from my body of experience can go into and flesh out an experience because you didn't work in the areas I work.
Also, you're not using a point of view. You're using... perception. You're actually looking into these things. And I don't have theories. I just keep looking into these things. Whereas most of the boys in these fields only have theories.
Well, and the theories aren't solidly grounded in real experience.
They have a point of view without ever having checked it out.
Yeah.
So that's why they're fads. The fad is based on just a point of view on particular problems. Whereas I never had a point of view. I just keep plugging away and looking into the problem.
You know, it's a fascinating thing to constantly look into the problem in relation to the current context, what is happening at this moment.
Yeah.
For instance,
well, that's ground, bigger ground.
20 years ago, 15 years ago, I started a thing which has become widely accepted across the whole field now, which is what I would call last line-itis.
Yeah.
And that is that in commercials, you find that they come up with a very attractive or involving last line, you see? And I started that with a little commercial for Johnson's baby powder where the last line in the commercial, last three lines, the little boy says to the mother he's visiting, "Do you have any other babies?" And she says, "No, he's the first." So the little boy says, "Too bad you had to get a bald-headed one."